History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And what we've learned, of course, is that they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take that initiative to ask a few questions and then invest enough time to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Next week, we're going to hear a story unlike any other we've heard on Hometown Heroes from a member of the Dutch Resistance during World War II, but I'm saving that for next time because of a convergence of factors I didn't want to miss the chance to highlight this weekend. We told you a while back about the idea of taking World War II veterans' interviews you've heard here on Hometown Heroes and turning them into a dramatized audio podcast with voice actors and audio production. That effort is getting closer to reality now. Retold World War II was featured at an industry convention called SonicCon this week in Virginia, and the concept was very warmly received. So keep your eyes and ears peeled for that, and if that's something you'd like to help make a reality, let us know. We can brainstorm. You can follow Retold World War II on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find links at hometownheroesradio.com. When that idea does become reality, perhaps some episodes might be devoted to experiences in an often overlooked battle in the Pacific that marks its 80th anniversary this week. We're going to be exploring that today. 35,000 Americans, about half of them Marines, converged on a tiny little atoll in the Gilbert Islands 80 years ago this week. More than 1,000 of those Marines would give their lives on that one square mile of terrain. More than 2,000 more wounded in a battle that lasted less than 4 days. You may have heard it pronounced Tarawa or Tarawa. The Japanese pronunciation was Tarawa. Those young Americans fighting there had never heard of it before, but would never forget it after. Many of them were teenagers, like Jack Venables, who had lied about his age and joined the Marines at just 15 years old.
I was told by the recruiting sergeant that he would be able to put me in the same outfit that my brother was in. And I said, well, I'm not quite 17. He said, don't worry about it. He said, I'll tell you where you can use as a birthplace because the Hall of Records is burned down. They can't prove or disprove your age. So I went in at age 15, as did my brother. We were 13 months apart. I was the younger one of the two.
And you know, I've had other veterans tell me that they lied about their age or they got their parents to sign for them or this or that. But I haven't had anyone tell me that he was able to find a loophole of a small town in Texas where the Hall of Records had burnt down. I guess there's no way to count how many people did this, but it sounds like this was a fairly common thing with that particular Marine Corps recruiter that he pointed people to fill it out this way and you'll get in?
I think so with young people, of course, younger than legal age for the military.
And what was that town in Texas?
Farwell. And it's interesting because when I was overseas and I was in a hospital due to malaria, it's a field hospital, it was in a tent actually, and some guy was yelling, hey Tex, hey Tex, and it was one of the corpsmen. I didn't realize he was calling me. And until I finally turned around and realized it was trying to get a hold of me. So anyway, it was kind of funny at the time.
So you'd never even set foot in Texas, and here you are listed that way. And what possessed you, 15 years old, to want to go fight a war? Where did that come from?
Stupidity.
Had you known, huh?
Had I known. No, I'm kidding. I don't know why. I wanted to be with my brother, mainly. We grew up together, and we were real good friends. We were at the island right next to the main island of Tarawa. Now, that was atoll. Gilbert Islands is what they were called. And so Tarawa was the main thrust of the battle, and that's where they were dug in so well, it's unbelievable. They had built bunkers, and they were difficult. The only way we were able to get them out was with a flamethrower, for the most part, or throwing hand grenades in there.
And your brother was part of that main landing force?
I thought he was. Another friend of mine and I went looking for him, and when the tide's out, you can walk between the islands, which we were doing. We had our rifles and well prepared in case we ran into some Japanese. But we'd ask about the six Marines as we'd see different people. Have you seen them? Yeah, they just passed not long ago. And so we kept going and going, and it was hot as heck. And finally, the tide started coming in, and my buddy said, well, we've got to go back, and we're not going to find him. And so we did. We started going back. No, the tide was coming in, and so pretty soon it's up to our ankles and then up to our knees. By the time we got to the island right next to Tarawa, almost, well, it was at our chest height, and we had our rifles held above our heads trying to get back to the island, and Amtrak came by with a bunch of other Marines in it. And they laughing like heck. I should say laughing like hell. That's what they were doing. And they plucked us out of the water and took us back to the main island.
In the years since, when you have read about that battle and you see the number of casualties, you realize how bad it was for so many. Has that added to your perspective of what you were a part of there? How significant that chapter of the World War II history was?
It's interesting because before we landed, we were still aboard ship and they were bringing back casualties, all shot up. And I'll tell you, that isn't spooky. Knowing that we're going to go in, fortunately we didn't land on the main island, but there were bodies floating on the water by the time we got in. So it was terrible.
That was Jack Venables. He and his older brother were two of the teenage Marines who survived the Battle of Tarawa 80 years ago this week. Another was Bob Andre, who had quit school after his mother passed away when he was just 15.
I was lucky I didn't go in the first wave. And so that they're the ones who the brains-to-be miscalculated the tide. And they went in. It was not shallow, low tide. It was high tide. And then they were, when they jumped off the Amtraks or whatever we had going in, they were caught right in front of the machine because the machine guns were about 8 feet in a wall that we didn't have much land to land on, only about 8 feet. Then there's a wall, and the machine guns were right there going into it.
So if you had been in the first wave, you probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to me.
Yeah, they got the bulk of it, and the ones that were wounded end up dying during the night. All night long, they're calling for help, help, but nobody could get to them. And slowly you hear the help, 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 just fade away because the Japs were out on the pier, which was their toilet. And how they determined how many Japs were on the island, they took an aerial view of the toilets, figured how many used the toilets, and that's how many Japs they figured was on the island, how they calculated it. So the next morning, we over the wall, and then we were just going from coconut tree to coconut tree or body to body, whatever was any protection, you know.
Well, and that was my question when you got there. And here you're, you're 17 years old?
Yes, yeah.
17-year-old, never been in combat before. What did you see and hear and experience when you first got on that island?
Well, the thing we were doing is trying to get there because we were told to get there. And as far as thinking, I wasn't thinking at all. I was just doing what I was told.
What did you see?
Well, just bodies all over the place, and we would stay as low as possible to keep from getting hit.
And were they able to get you all the way to shore, or were you guys hung up on the reef too and you had to wade in?
No, we went in rubber boats. Okay. Yeah, so we were able to get in. We got a lot of bullets in the rubber boats, but they were with so many compartments that it didn't sink. Yeah.
So you're 17 years old. You're coming ashore with dead American bodies all over the place and bullets flying your way. Yeah. Were you scared?
I didn't have time to think about that. I really didn't. And plus, being 17 and young, you didn't know what the hell was going on.
Something tells me that must have been a pretty long day for you.
Well, it sure was. It started at dark, early in the morning, aboard the ship, mm-hmm. loading up, going over the cargo nets on the ship. No, it was a long day. But when you don't get hurt, you don't think much of it.
But I'm sure some stuff came pretty close to you.
Oh, yeah, all around us. Yeah, sure. They're bouncing off everything. You don't think anything about it. I didn't. I was just doing what I was told, is getting from point A to point B without getting shot.
So you spent that whole time following these machine guns and keeping the ammunition supply going?
Staying in my position, stay where I belonged, yeah.
How'd you sleep that first night?
I didn't, because they put me out on a point. This a lot of people don't know about, but they called me and he said, go out about 10, 20 feet out there. Well, turns out when I went out about 10 or 20 feet, there were Japs there. I can hear them talking. And then he finally realized what they had done. They called me back. I crawled out and I crawled back. Yeah, because you could hear him jabbering over there. Yeah.
How close do you think you were to him?
Here to her.
10 feet.
Yeah, easy. Uh-huh. Easy. But I've been closer.
Well, you're teasing us now. I'm sure there's more to come in this story here.
That's another battle.
Well, we'll get to it, I'm sure, as long as you're willing. So how long were you there? And I say an island, really. This is an atoll, a few different strips of land kind of in a collection.
That was on Bito. It was the name of the island itself. That's where all the fighting took place. Now, some of the Japs left to the other islands, and they're a horseshoe shape. After 78 hours or so, then we start cleaning up the bodies of our boys. Then they told us we had to load up on the Amtrak. We were going to the other islands because the ones that are left are on the other islands running away, going around. And we went from island to island, which was we waded across. They're low tide, you can wade across from island to island. But we went about, six or seven islands, and then they replaced us. They brought other outfit in to relieve us, and we went back to the ship. And from there, we went back to Hawaii.
Well, and you say that, you know, you guys had to clean up the dead American bodies. That had to be hard, especially for a 17-year-old. How do you handle something like that?
Well, 17, you really don't know much about life. So, again, I was told to, I went with a minister, preacher, what was it? A priest or something, to go around. He would take their rings and watch off and search their pockets and then take them back to the tent at nighttime, and he'd go through them and clean out anything that shouldn't be in the wallet and stuff like that. Then at that time, we would have a stretcher or a litter or whatever, and we'd load the body on there and take it to the airstrip. And let the airstrip, we had 7 or 8 or 10 of them, something like that. The first one was a Navajo Indian. He was behind a stump of a coconut tree, and he was shot right through the radio and right through the head.
Yeah. Did you lose any of your friends there?
Oh, yeah. Egghead Epperson, he was killed. Matter of fact, he was awarded the Medal of Honor. He was from our squad, yeah.
What had he done that they gave him that award posthumously?
Well, he was in foxhole, and Japs were throwing hand grenades at him. He pulled them underneath him. Even though their hand grenades weren't very powerful, but they did the job. They killed him.
So he sacrificed his own life to save others?
Yeah, two other guys in a hole with him.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people have referred to your actions in World War II as heroic, and we're going to hear more about what you did. But just hearing you tell me that story about Epperson, sounds like he's someone who you might have seen as a hero.
Well, absolutely. He had a head shaped like an egg. It was, we all nicknamed him Egghead. I was Prune Picker because I was California. And they named a ship after him, a couple of them. Had it for so many years, and they gave it to some foreign country and sold it. And they built another one, named it after him, yeah. But that was about the end of that battle. That didn't last that long.
Yeah, it was quick, but it was devastating. It was bloody. It was deadly.
Oh, yeah. You ask about sleeping. I don't know if anybody else slept. I sure as hell didn't. Whatever I got was lucky.
Well, and I hear you talk about other guys who died there. And I have to wonder if there were moments in a foxhole or behind a stump or even while you're carrying a body on a litter where you maybe wondered, am I next? How long am I going to last out here?
No, you just try to... I really did. I don't remember thinking that way. I'm sure I was afraid or scared, but as far as thinking about it, I never really thought about it. Again, I go back to my age. Just don't think about it. I wasn't any kind of hero or anything like that. I just... nothing registered.
A glimpse into the mindset of those Marines on Tarawa 80 years ago this week. Bob Andre would go on to earn the Silver Star on Saipan less than a year later. He was wounded there as well. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when this special episode continues, more memories of the brutal combat conditions on Tarawa, plus the view from a veteran who had to deliver those Marines to that horrific scene, and one who was sent there to document what was happening. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking 80 years since the Battle of Tarawa. It was a tragic battle for the more than 1,000 U.S. Marines who gave their lives there. How strategic was 1 square mile of land in the Gilbert Islands? That remains a topic of debate. But one thing that is not disputed, the lesson learned by our military when invasion forces got hung up on the coral reef. That would lead to the rapid development of underwater demolition teams, predecessors to today's Navy SEALs. One Navy veteran who knew all about that coral reef was Dan Cano, whose job as a teenager at Tarawa 80 years ago was to deliver Marines to shore on his Higgins boat. And those LCVPs were not exactly impenetrable fortresses.
Well, it has a Gray Marine diesel engine, and they're about 35 feet long, and a capacity of 32 troop men to get into the boat. And it will take a Jeep and a Hauser and all the supplies you can pile in there. You know, you had a certain amount. You watch your water line. You didn't go too far, otherwise you'd sink.
And what is it made out of?
Plywood. 3/4-inch plywood. And we went in on an invasion. They'd handed us a bag of corks, different sizes, to plug the bullet holes. And if you got shrapnel hit the side and it was too big, you had a canvas. The deckhand and the engineer would jump over the side and pull the canvas around and tie it to plug up the hole. Water would seep through, but it wasn't gushing in and keep you from sinking. When you pull in Pearl, they refurbish the ship and repair it and whatever, and then they load troops on. And you know you're going for a push, but you don't know where. And then after 2 or 3 days out at sea, they call everybody into the room. They unveil the map on the wall and said, "We're going to Tarawa, Beto." That was the name of the island. Tarawa's the atoll.
And this is not a very big place. It's, I mean, barely shows up on the map. It's so tiny.
Yeah, it's about 1.5 miles long and not even 1/2 mile wide. But the Japanese have been fortifying it since 20 years or something like that, a long time. They had no idea that when we went there was going to be the lowest tide that had ever taken place. And it was over 1/2 mile, about 3/4 miles from the reef to the beach.
They didn't know where the reefs were or how close to the surface those reefs were. They didn't, from what I've heard, they didn't even consider the possibility that landing craft could get hung up on these coral reefs heading into Tarawa, right?
Yeah.
Had you guys been briefed on the potential for coral reefs or anything?
No, we just figured you're just going to go in and land and come out, you know. But this reef was tremendous. And what they had a dock. They had bombed it. And the end had dropped into the water. That's where the boat officer set up his headquarters at the end of the pier. It was at an angle. It was having trouble, you know, standing up on it, you know. And then they started rigging it up so they can hang on to something, you know. But once we found out about the low tide, and the first time that they came up with an Amtrak because of this encounter with reefs, they made a tank lighter than the tank. The tracks had blades on it, and that would propel the landing vehicle. But the troops had to jump over the top and into the water. And there was about a good 5 feet or better that you jump from the site into the water. And these guys had all their packs and rifles and everything on them. And if they hit a hole, they went straight down like a rock. So started across the reef, and they just became targets because they could pick them off like shooting deals in a carnival.
And this is one of the big lessons learned at Tarawa, as you're illustrating, is that in future invasions, they sent the frogmen in with explosives to take out some of those reefs to make a path for the landing craft to come in. But you guys are flying completely blind to all that when you get there. Walk me through how that invasion unfolded, because you're on your APA, but then you've got to load up your LCVP and take a crew of Marines into Tarawa?
Yeah, we were the second wave, and we had about six boats in a wave. The first wave was the Amtraks, and then we were the second wave. We're going to go follow them. And then once we got there, the boat officer leading the wave, he saw what the problem was, and we couldn't go no further. And they started communicating, hey, we got a problem. And then the Marines are getting slaughtered, the ones that made it to the beach. We were right at the edge of the reef, and you had to keep moving because they were popping you left and right. You were just sitting targets out there.
So you get up to the reef with 30 or so Marines, and machine gun bullets are hitting your LCVP?
No, I was lucky. I never got hit.
But they're sailing over you. You're hearing them, and you're seeing guys die in front of you.
Seeing boats being hit. And then there was a coastal freighter that used to, it belonged to Australia, I think. That was an Australian coastal freighter that used to go inner island, you know, running supplies and ferrying people back and forth. When the Japanese taken all these islands, they took over that coastal freighter and they used it. And then the Navy sunk it about 25 yards away from the pier, at the end of the pier. And the Japanese had set up machine gun nests on the deal. So, and then once we found out that the only way you could get into the beach was alongside the pier, because they dug the reef out there, and there was a channel, and you could go in to the beach, but one boat at a time. So when the first boat went in, the boat officer was in the first boat. He told Johnson, okay, sailor, let's go in. And this book that I have, the boat officer says, that kid says was pretty brave. He says, standing out there, going into the pier. And then once we got to the pier, the Japanese had been built platforms on the pilings, and they strapped themselves to the piling. And as you came by, they'd start shooting at you. So they call in the Marines and a flamethrower. They put them on Johnson's boat, and he was going through, and they come to the pier, and the guy pop you, the guy shoot him with a flamethrower. And after the battle and everything, Johnson was got Silver Star, second under the Congressional Medal for his bravery and going in and cleaning that out.
Well, let's talk about your experience. So you take that first crew of Marines in there. You can't get past the reef, right? And do you have a backlog of boats at that point, too, in your way?
Well, yeah, they're all out there waiting. You know, we'd take our turns going in the channel and we'd unloading the troops. So both sides of the channel, our landing on the map, that was Red Beach, and that was our target, Red Beach. So it spread it from the pier, you know, about 100 feet or so. So that was our area to unload, and then the other one's just on down the line. We were supposed to go there, so we started going in on taking turns going in and out of the deal. Then once the tide come in, then we could just go right into the beach. They've been building that thing for 20-some-odd years, and at the very point of the island. It's, if you look at the island from the air, it looks like a bird. And at the top of the head of the bird, they build the bunker. The bombs would bounce off the damn thing. They pile it up with sand and build a bunker, and they build another layer. And then each layer had slits where they could shoot at you. And the planes, you see the bombs just bouncing off the top of the thing. It would not penetrate. So the Marines had to go in there and get to the slits and throw grenades and stuff, work their way up. At the very end, they had an old 8-inch gun that they got from the British or from the First World War. And they had it all ranged in. You could come from any angle, and they could pick you off with that 8-inch gun. So they started hitting us. As soon as we got into range, we started getting hit, shell by the gun.
So you saw some things that you'd never seen before. What were some of the things that you witnessed there that are still in your memory or in, if you close your eyes, you can still picture them?
It was a carnage. All those Marines that got killed trying to get to the beach off those Amtraks and on the beach, the whole beach was just bodies floating in the water. You could probably walk on those bodies all the way across. There's so many of them. And the beach was same littered. I went in, dumped troops, and they put all the wounded in there. They gave us a box of syringes of morphine. They said, just kill the pain and get them back on the ship, bandage them up. And I had to steer the boat, but the deckhand and the engineer were taking care of them. And they brought this Marine. His face, lower part of his face was blown off. And he had his notebook. He was a sergeant. He had a notebook. He wrote, he said, no morphine for me. He said, wound in the head. He was conscious, still able to communicate. So all we could do is, put bandages on him and get him back to the ship. God only knows what happened to him. We got back, got restored. But the carnage was what we saw. Because before, all the killings and dead bodies were on the beach. And at Tarawa, it was on the reef. You go online, and Google Tarawa invasion, and there's pictures there of the bodies laying all over the place.
And those pictures had a powerful effect. We hear a lot about the flag raising at Iwo Jima and what that did for the war bond drives and all that. But before that, they were at Tarawa in 1943, and the photos and even a movie, they made a documentary of that invasion that won an Oscar, but also had the effect of getting Americans' attention of what the fight against the Japanese was going to be like, and certainly that proved true. But you're there witnessing all this, and you're a teenager. You're what, 18 years old, and looking at bodies that are mangled and guys that are killed, and you're getting handwritten notes from a Marine who's so brave and so courageous that he doesn't even want morphine with a face that's blown apart. How did you process all of that? How did you keep doing your job in the midst of that horror?
Well, you have to keep on going. You couldn't stop. I mean, you got to save yourself. You got to save everybody.
Again, that was Dan Cano, and who knows, perhaps one of the many Marines he carried to shore or back on the LCVP was another teenager named Glenn Brehm, who carried his own vivid memories of Tarawa.
Well, it was tough. The landing, there was, when you got on the beach, we had about a 1-foot foothold on there because you couldn't, we were right up against a little barrier, and you couldn't stick your head up because it'd peck at you, and the waves that came in later were getting more punishment than we took. And some of them got dumped into 10 or 15 feet of water, too. The boats didn't come in far enough.
Yeah.
The second day was worse, but finally we got them straightened out a little bit where they could get in. But in fact, I think they said that after the first day, they didn't think they were going to send any more in. There was no use, but they did. But it took 4 days, and the island was only a couple of miles long and, I don't know, 3/4 of a mile wide at the widest spot.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fast, and they had pillboxes that were, I don't know, 6 or 7 stories deep. And that's why they bombed them for weeks and thought they had everything cleaned out. But they were just like squirrels that go down, and after the shelling was over, they'd come back up again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just imagining you and how ill-prepared you must have been as a teenager who's never been in combat
before,
what you're up against.
Yeah.
How did you handle that? Were you scared? I mean, did you think you were going to survive it?
Well, you just wonder when you were going to get hit, I guess. But, I mean, sure, you were scared, and you prayed a little bit. Like they said, that there's no atheists in the foxhole. But anyway, when you're young, the older you get, the more you really think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Then after we were only on there 4 days, and then that was over, then we came home and went to Hawaii then.
Well, you probably needed to recover from what you endured there and what you saw. And you said, you know, you're waiting to get hit. Well, while you're waiting, you're seeing other guys get hit.
Oh, yeah.
What was that like? And I'm sure some of these guys are guys, if you didn't know them, you'd been around them, you'd seen them.
Yeah.
What was that like? And can you give us a sense of what you witnessed there and how hard it was?
I don't know how to explain it. I mean, you see something like that, and you can't believe it, really, when you see a guy get blown up, some of them getting hit in the head. It's tough to even think about.
Glenn Bram survived the Battle of Tarawa 80 years ago this week. He would make it through the battles of Saipan and Tinian before being wounded in the shoulder on Okinawa. It's time for our final break now, but when we come back, another Marine who made it through those four brutal days, and one more whose job was to capture all of that devastation on film. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking 80 years since the Battle of Tarawa in the Pacific. Before we get the unique perspective of a filmographer whose work on Tarawa led to an Academy Award, let's hear from another one of those 18,000 Marines that converged on that tiny outpost in the Gilbert Islands. Nebraska native Laverne Coulthard actually experienced his 21st birthday on Tarawa on the final day of that four-day battle, later referred to as 76 hours of hell.
76 hours of hell. I mean, you never got any rest, but it was over fast. But they had about 5,000 men on Tarawa, and we was one division. Only four prisoners were taken. It was their Imperial Marine Navy people that occupied that island, and they fought to the death. They didn't surrender. The ones that were surrendered, and I understood there was four, were wounded, couldn't help themselves. About the reef that surrounded the island, they couldn't get us in landing boats, and we had to wade in. And that's where we got chewed up bad, but their emplacements were all underground, and of course naval gunfire and bombing didn't bother them, you know. They were there, so you had to just go in and burn them out, and with flamethrowers and hand grenades, and And that was difficult, too, to get close enough to work that stuff. But there was a bad battle. In fact, I think it was the worst battle the United States had ever fought at that time, from what I heard. And we got a presidential unit citation. We had to transfer. We couldn't get over the reef in Higgins' boats. So we waited. The first wave went in Higgins' boat and what in Amtrak's. And what got back with their Amtrak's picked us up, took us in, but they had learned they couldn't go too close. We're getting machine gunned all the way in and mortared and so forth. And so they told us to get out. We had to wade in. I imagine I probably waded in 300 yards maybe. And didn't never expect to get there, you know what I mean?
Well, were there guys falling left and right in front of you? I mean, did you see guys get hit on your way in?
When I went out of the Amtrak, the kid in front of me got hit. Kid behind me got hit. When I got in the water, one on each side of me went down dead. And by then, you don't pay attention. You just try to get to that seawall. And no more than got to the seawall, you get our breath a little bit, and some sergeant or lieutenant or somebody said, everybody that's been wounded over the seawall. So away we went. We went over the seawall, and then we got into the middle of it.
And that was just the beginning of 76 hours.
But we survived, some of us. There's no atheists, they say, in foxholes. That's true. But I tell you, you don't have time to be afraid at times. You just know you're going to get killed, so you go do what you can do. And that's the way I approached it.
Again, more than 1,000 Marines gave their lives in less than 4 days of the battle for Tarawa, another 2,000 wounded. And there to document it, a Marine Corps film crew. Bill Kelleher's unique assignment as a filmographer there put him in even more danger when it came to Tarawa's infamous coral reef.
It was the thing that caused so much damage to our troops, or so many deaths and wounds and so forth, because the Amtrak's got hung up on the reef, on the coral and one thing and another, and we had to walk in about 600 yards to shore, and the beach where I landed, they had us being fired on from both left and right sides and the front. So, you know, just all kinds of crossfire, and there were so many guys that they never did reach shore. They died in the water before they even got to land.
Here you are trying to get onto the island, wading through 600 yards of water. These guys are crouching down to try to avoid the bullets, and you couldn't do that. Tell us why not.
Well, my buddy Norm Hatch and I, we had to walk standing up because we had camera belts and all with the cameras and film and everything, and we couldn't duck down because we would ruin the film, and then that there would be no reason for us to even try to get ashore. So we just we were really walking bullseyes, I thought. But the thing that we never have understood is that with all the guys that got killed and hurt, and some of them blown apart, and some of them just ripped apart by machine gun fire and one thing and another, he and I never got a scratch. In fact, in all of the invasions we made, none of us had any kind of serious wounds other than Ray Majasek on Saipan lost a leg. The very first thing that I saw, you know, after we got on the shore, we had a beachhead of, I don't know, you know, 15 or 20 feet, I don't know, but in off to the side in front of me, a Marine had been hit, and a Navy corpsman was treating him, and one of the snipers got the corpsman right through the cheek, you know, and God, he just started bleeding, and he put his hand up and drew it away, and it just covered with blood. He reached into his pack, and he got one of those heavy bandages they have, and he put that up on his face. You know, he just patted in place, and it stuck. And he went back and worked on the Marine. I said, I thought that was the very first thing I saw like that. I said, God, that guy needs a medal. As far as I was concerned, he would have had one. And that sort of thing happened frequently. So those guys were tremendous. They really they just did a whale of a job. A lot of guys survived because of the work that they and doctors did.
Well, and the work that you did was important too. I want to talk a little bit more about that in a second. First, I don't want to gloss past this. Here you are wading through the water. I imagine that water wasn't Pacific blue. it probably had a pretty good red tint.
It was red in a lot of places, up near the shore especially. It was turning red. The bodies were floating in the water up there. Just so many guys that got hit, and they couldn't make it. And some of them, of course, were dead. But the bodies were floating, and there was a lot of blood to flow too.
And that couldn't have been encouraging for you or anybody around you. What goes through your head? Do you think, what am I doing here? How am I even going to think about getting this camera out of my pack and shooting some film here?
Well,
what am I doing?
These are things. I don't know, Paul. I think that the adrenaline must be flowing rapidly or excessively rapidly, because you don't stop to think about that, because you're supposed to be getting pictures of the action, and there certainly was plenty of action there, and so that's what we were doing. After it was over, you know, you sit down and stop and think about it, and you know, my God, how did I get through that, or how come I didn't get touched, and all these other guys, things happened to them. You know, it's a funny feeling. But when it actually was going on, I really don't think that we thought about it.
Didn't really have time to, I guess.
No, that's right.
What did you do? Did you try to find a place with a little bit of cover and just...
Well, you tried, but there wasn't very much cover on that island. You know, it was only a mile and a half long and a half mile wide, and golly, I mean, there just was no elevation to it at all. The highest point on the island was the Japanese, what was the headquarters, and it was like a huge, a very heavily enforced room that rose up possibly 15 to 20 feet, and that was the highest spot on the island.
This is this reinforced blockhouse that you've seen pictures of?
That thing, it had sloped sides, and they used coconut logs that were crisscrossed, and then in cement. They were about 8 feet thick, and before we landed, the Navy just bombarded the living daylights out of the thing. You know, I mean, they were shooting 1,000-pound shells over there, and they didn't make a dent in that thing. And the way we finally got them out, or the way the troops finally got them out, was dropping hand grenades and charges down the air vents and smoke, you know, to smoke them out. And then when they came out, they got shot. But the bombardment, it just didn't faze that thing. Talk about armor plate, boy, those coconut logs and that cement, they were really something. And the guys, the Japanese came pouring out of there. There was one entrance that I guess was the only entrance to it, because that's where they all came out, and they just were sitting ducks at that point. I mean, they didn't stand a chance. Throughout the island, the Japanese were masters at digging in, you know, and camouflaging, and you don't know they're there. They were using smokeless powder, and guys are getting popped off, and you didn't know where the fire was coming from, because there was no smoke when the shells were, you know, when the bullets were shot, or when they were shot, and you had to dig them out. We used flamethrowers in most of the places, you know, to force them out, and as I say, when it was all over, they just had the 17 of them left.
It's hard to believe. I want to talk a little more about what you were doing all this time and how much you actually got to roll film, because you didn't have that much film. What was it, about 20 feet of film in each roll?
No, 100.
100 feet.
100 feet, yeah. But the cameras we were using, they were IMO three-turret lens cameras, 35-millimeter film, 100-foot spools, and they were hand-cranked. And, you know, you'd be filming, and all of a sudden you have to stop and crank up some more. Later on, we had the ones that would just keep going, but those cameras at that time were hand-crank deals, and so you only got a few minutes of shooting, you know, with a crank, and then you had to stop and do it again. So it was a case of one guy, if he ran out, the other guy would load up and shoot, and or be shooting, and then the fellow would reload his camera. We just went back and forth, you know, that way, so that we tried to get all the action all the time, didn't lose anything.
Are there some specific images that stick out in your mind, or pieces, sequences of film that you captured that you saw through your lens? You talked about the corpsman getting hit in the face, having half his face blown off, but you weren't rolling film on that yet. Tell us some of the things that you did see.
I hadn't got my camera out. Hadn't got my camera. That would have been one of the crackerjack things to have, because after that, the most of the stuff that we saw was just the battle itself. There was one spot where Norm Hatch was my buddy, and he got a few frames of Japanese and American troops firing at one another. This was up at that blockhouse, and I think that was the only film shot during the war, as far as I know, where it showed both sides in the same frames shooting at one another. Most of it was you shooting at them, them shooting at you, but not at the same time, and showing both of them. And it just was quite a spectacular shot. And
did you ever have any moments where you're shooting something and you almost got shot, or you were a little too close to the action, had to find another point of view?
The bullets were, I mean, you know, they probably were very close to me, but when you've got your eye up there, that eyepiece, and you've got one eye in the eyepiece, the other eye's closed, I guess, and you don't realize it. Once in a while you'd hear something whistling by, but you didn't know whether it was real close or to the side of you. But as I say, we just someone was sure looking out for us, because we were in the thick of it and never got touched. It must have been close. I mean, that was a Tarawa. I had a couple of close ones other times, you know, during the war. But that one was the one that I never will understand how we got through that one that way without being hit.
It is pretty hard to fathom. As for those moving pictures Bill Kelleher captured on Tarawa, they were shown to President Roosevelt, who thought all of America should see it. With the Marines at Tarawa became an Academy Award-winning documentary that also helped sell war bonds.
It was shown throughout in theaters throughout the United States, and I guess that it really did jack up the sales of bonds and so forth. And after the war was over, Norm and I found out that the film had been given a special Oscar at the Academy Awards in 1944. We didn't even know about it. The award went to the Marine Corps, and the Oscar went to General Smith, who was the commanding general, and it in turn ended up in the museum at Quantico, at the Marine Museum. That's where it is now. Although the thing went to the division and all that, we were pretty happy about the fact that we were involved in it.
Because metal was needed for the war effort, that 1944 Oscar awarded to the Marine Corps was actually made out of plaster. I have the film with the Marines at Tarawa linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also link to the full-length original interviews with each of the six Tarawa survivors we heard from on today's program. One final note, as we mark the 80th anniversary of that battle this week, some of those more than 1,000 Marines who gave their lives in that four-day clash have yet to have their remains identified. Government researchers continue to work through that process to make sure those Gold Star heroes are properly honored and their families find the closure they deserve. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.